Hi, I'm Gene Stevens at Collingwood's Elvis Fest, and I'm really pleased to be speaking with Sam Thompson. Sam, you were working with Elvis as his bodyguard.
Yeah, I met Elvis in 72. He met my sister, and I was a cop in Memphis. And I was actually, I had been the bodyguard for Danny Thomas in Memphis when he built St. Jude Hospital. So I'd been trained in dignitary protection and self-defense and those things, crowd control. So Elvis loved cops. And when he found out that Linda's brother was a cop, then he wanted to meet me. So, and I wanted to meet him, of course. So we hit it off pretty quickly. And I went to the first recording session at Stax Studios in December of 73. And he did the Promised Land album. And then I went to Hawaii with him for the Aloha Special as a, just an extra security. And then it just took off from there.
Yeah.
And
you were with Elvis in 72, as you said, towards the start of his touring years, return to touring.
Yeah.
So you did a lot of on-site protection checking out the locations where he'd be playing.
Well, yeah, in those years I was just Elvis's friend, and I was Linda's brother, but we became fast friends, and we'd go motorcycle riding together, things like that. I didn't have any official association with him, but I was a trained professional protection specialist, so I would go with his bodyguards, Red and Sonny West and those guys, and participate and help. And in 73, he bought me a house right next to Graceland. He bought my mother and father a house, my sister a house, and me a house right next to his father's house.
Always so generous.
Yeah, and he wanted family. We thought we were going to be family. Yeah.
Linda, your sister, was his partner for a while.
Live-in girlfriend.
That's
she lived at Graceland for 4.5 years. So we thought of Elvis as our putative brother-in-law, and I treated him as such, and he treated me as such, and he was very generous to me. But in 76, he fired his principal bodyguards for whatever reason he had. I don't really get into all that. But
did that mean it was your end as well?
No. I wasn't working for him.
Okay.
So that's when he called me and said, I need you to come. He literally had no security at that point. He had one guy left who was an ex-police officer. And Elvis called me and offered me the position. And I was honored. I was pretty happy with the sheriff's department. I was a sergeant. And I could play with Elvis, but I had a real life too. And I guess if that had not happened, I wouldn't have worked for him because I was just his friend. But I ended up working for him on the payroll the last couple of years of his life and handled all of his security in California and Palm Springs and on tour in Memphis.
In Memphis. Well, those last 2 years, of course, are heartbreaking for every Elvis fan.
Yeah.
And I'd love to ask you a sensitive question. What was he like in those last 2 years? We know physically what he looked like.
Yeah.
What was he like as a person and a friend?
Well, I'm going to tell you, Elvis loved being Elvis. And I think there's a great myth that Elvis was somehow fat and 40 and depressed and sitting up there in that room and gloomy, and that's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
Elvis loved being Elvis, and he was looking forward to that last tour the night before he died. I was upstairs with him going over the tour schedule because I was taking Lisa Marie back to Priscilla the next morning and then catching the tour back in Portland, Maine. And he was telling me, and this is going to be the best tour I've ever had, and after this tour, we're going to take a little time off, and then we're going to go to Europe. And we talked about going over to Wembley Arena, and he was going to send three of us over there, and he was going to try to book a tour of Europe, and he was just ebullient. You know, he was happy. And that's who Elvis really was. Now, you know, there's no doubt that he had medical conditions that affected his life, and he had an addiction to prescription pills. No question about that. I fully admit it. In fact, he fired me one time because I told him that he had this problem. There was no Betty Ford Clinic back then, Gene.
No. And you were one of the few people who dared to even say no to him.
There were others.
Yeah.
In fact, Red and Sonny, I think one of the principal reasons that, frankly, that they were fired is that they confronted him, and he didn't want to hear it. And he told me he didn't want to hear it, and he fired me. So I went home, and about a day later, they called me back, and I went upstairs, and Elvis hired me back. And I told him when he hired me back, look, you know, we're not going to quit talking about this. He says, well, I don't want to hear it anymore. I said, well, then don't hire me back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he did. And I just felt like he needed somebody. By this time, he and Linda were not together.
Right.
They broke up in November of 76. We were playing the Cow Palace in San Francisco.
Right.
But I stayed with him until he died. So we had a whole different relationship, you know. I went from sort of like maybe a brother-in-law to maybe just a friend. But maybe one that would talk to him pretty frankly. But I felt like he needed somebody there that would just tell him the truth and not worry about their job. Because I had a job, I did. I went back to the sheriff's department 2 weeks after Elvis died and went to law school and became a judge and did other things in Memphis.
Would it be fair, since I'm talking to an ex-cop, to call you a member of the Memphis Mafia?
That is fair, yeah, yeah. Some people call it the Inner Circle, they call it the Memphis Mafia, whatever, you know, but yeah, that was us, yeah.
I've heard a lot and read a lot about how he enjoyed being with you guys, not as a star, but as a friend, playing sports together, tossing the ball, and actually sitting down and just jamming with you guys.
And just talking.
Mm-hmm.
People ask me my favorite memory, and it's not one of the concerts, and it's not the house or the gifts. It's the nights that we would just sit upstairs in his bedroom with open books and talk about everything in life and where he came from and where I came from and what we hoped and what our fears were in life. And one of his great fears in life, and he was open about it, is nobody will ever remember me. You know, I'm just a musician, and this will all be gone. And I remember one night he said, you know, nobody cares about that. And I said, no, Elvis, you gotta be wrong, man. People love you. I mean, they're loved all over the world. And he stopped me. He said, no, they love that guy up on the stage. That's an icon. They don't know me. And he's sitting there cross-legged on his bed, his hair's all messed up, and he's got blue pajamas on. I looked at him and I realized he's just a human being.
Yeah,
and there were moments, just brief moments, not a lot. I don't pretend to be his best friend. I'm the first one to tell you that. There are many who will tell you they were. I used to say, if I ever wrote a book, Gene, I'm going to title it, I Was Not Elvis's Best Friend, because apparently everybody else was, you know. But, you know, there were brief moments when he would just open up and we would talk, and I would almost forget that that's Elvis Presley there. It was just Elvis, you know. And that's what I treasure the most, those brief little moments with the humanity and the humility and the frailness and the vulnerability that we all have and we share with people that are close to us. When they came through, those are my warmest memories.
The dark day, 42 years ago this August, can I ask you where you were and how you found out the news of his death?
I was at Graceland. My father had driven me over there in a car that Elvis bought me, a Lincoln, and to drop me off, because I had to be there to take Lisa Marie, who was 5 years old, back to Priscilla. I was the principal bodyguard that ferried her between Elvis and Priscilla, because they had joint custody. And I had two children, so Elvis trusted me. And as he said, I was the only one who could get Lisa Marie to eat her vegetables on the plane. Because we flew under an assumed name, and I flew armed in those days, you know, for kidnapping issues and all. So I was there to pick up Lisa. And suddenly there was just pandemonium. The ambulance was there. And Elvis was found upstairs in the bathroom. I just remembered, you know, there's a little 9-year-old girl here that I'm responsible for.
Yes.
That's her father up there.
Yes.
So I started looking around the house, and she was in her grandmother, Dodger. Minnie Mae Presley was Elvis's grandmother, who lived at Graceland. And little Lisa Marie, 9 years old at that time, she was in the room, and she had remembered my sister's phone number at 9. And Lynn and Elvis hadn't even been together for 6 or 8 months. And she picked that phone up, and the first person Lisa Marie called was Linda. And she was on the phone. She was saying, no, Linda, my daddy's dead. They tell me they found him upstairs. He's dead. And so I just walked over and took the phone from her, and I could hear my sister say, oh, no, Lisa, I'm sure he's okay. I'm sure he's okay. And I said, Linda, you need to come home. And Linda threw the phone against the wall. And then she went and picked it up. And she got on the phone, was crying. I said, yeah. So they just found him. You need to come home. And so that's where I was. And, of course, then I called Dick Grobe, the other bodyguard, who was at home. And I told him what happened, and he went down to Baptist Hospital to secure the scene. I stayed at Graceland. I called the sheriff, the chief of police, and we cordoned everything off because it was pandemonium. We had 250,000 people out there, and we had everything out there. We had National Guard. We had the Red Cross. So I had to set everything up, you know, and liaise with all these different agencies to get all that done, and then work with Vernon Presley, his father, and Joe Esposito, his road manager, to get the funeral put together with the Forest Hills Cemetery. And we did all that and didn't sleep for 3 days. And then the night the day they brought him back from Forest Hills Cemetery, we had a private viewing, and then we had a public viewing that lasted most of the day. And then Priscilla and Lisa and a few members of her family stayed at Graceland that night. And after a little while of the private viewing, Ann Margaret was there and James Brown and a few others. Priscilla came to me and she said, we're exhausted. Would you clear the house out so we can go to sleep? So I had to be the heavy and go and tell everybody to go home. And then I locked the doors, and then I had the shift midnight till 6 in the morning with Elvis laying in state with an open casket. It was me and a pot of coffee and an 870 Remington pump shotgun because there were threats to steal the body. And I had police around the house and all that, but I was in the house with Elvis with an open casket. So I had plenty of opportunity for closure, you know, to say my own goodbyes in my own way, you know, and assure myself that that, in fact, was my friend in the casket, and all these rumors about him faking his death weren't just that. And then the next day, we buried Elvis. And 2 weeks later, I was back in a sheriff's uniform of the sheriff's department. And then Vernon called me, his father, in October. And they had been threatened with lawsuits by Forest Hill Cemetery because people were chipping off the mausoleum for souvenirs. So they had to acquire permits to bury Elvis at Graceland, which they eventually did. And if people go now, those of you that are listening, if you've been to Graceland or go to Graceland, there's meditation gardens there. And it started with Elvis and his grandmother. I'm sorry, Elvis and his mother, Gladys. And in October of that year, I was in charge, at Vernon's request, of the sheriff's detail that disinterred their bodies at night. And then we brought them up in the back of Graceland. And I was there when they dug the graves and put them in and poured the concrete, and the vaults are there. And that was like the moments in your life, Gene, where you just feel the chapter turn, you know, and you know it's time for the next thing.
Yes.
And I was holding on, kind of clinging on until that moment. But when Elvis was buried back at Graceland, his mother was there, I just knew that was sort of the end of my, and I thought that would be it. I just went on with my life, went to law school. I was a lawyer. I was a prison master for 2 years in Memphis. I was a judge. And I looked up one day, and it's 15 years later, and I thought, what's going on here? You know, I'm still hanging on. And Graceland called me and wanted me to go to Germany with Charlie Hodge, one of his players. So in 92, on the 15th anniversary, I ended up going to Munich, Germany, and it just started there. And I've been doing this since then. You know, I mean, I've had real jobs in between, you know, where you can't do it all the time. But I go to the ones that I have friends at, or the ones that I like to go to, like this one in Collingwood. You know, it's a wonderful festival. But it's just remarkable to me that people are still here in throngs,
yes,
primarily because of Elvis and his music.
I would love to ask you what you think Elvis would have thought. You've already mentioned earlier that he didn't think he would be remembered. Now, 42 years later, you see this, and this is just one of several Elvis festivals around the world, thousands of so-called ETAs.
Yeah.
What do you think he would have thought of that?
Well, he really, there. You know, we had ETAs when he was alive. There's a guy named Johnny Hara, I remember. And you know, Elvis used to say that's, he had a lot of little quotes, but one of them was sincerity. That was what did he say? Emulation is the most sincere form of flattery. That's what he would say. And then he would say, well, they're okay if they're good, if they look good in the jumpsuit, you know, things like that. But I think he'd be very happy. You know, to me, Elvis's greatest legacy was his music. Yeah, there's so many things that he did iconically in terms of shattering myths and isms and culture and all of that. And people talk about that in his movies and all this.
Embodying the American dream.
Absolutely.
To rise from nothing to anything you want.
Well, like in America, the Horatio Alger story.
That's right.
You know, yeah, from, I mean, literally rags to riches. But he never forgot where he came from, his humanity and his humility. He never forgot that, and that stuck with him. And like with most of us, even in our successes and the recesses of our mind, the dark of night, we all have our doubts.
Yep.
You know, and except for you, because I know that you're great at what you do, but
hardly.
But you know, we do, and yeah, you know, we sort of self-examine ourselves, and Elvis did that too. And I think that's the key to remembering Elvis, is that he was human, he was frail, he was vulnerable, he was a man, he wasn't a god. When he stepped on that stage, he became a different person, and that's what a lot of people like to remember. But it's important to remember that he was just like the rest of us, and he had his good days and his bad days, but mostly he had his music, and I think that's the body of work that ought to be remembered.
Before I let you go, quick question about the years since. Have you stayed in touch with the family, with Priscilla, Lisa Marie?
Yeah. I wouldn't say I stay in a regular contact with Lisa Marie or Priscilla, because they're all grown now.
Yeah.
But I do see Priscilla from time to time. We're friends. Lisa Marie, you know, she's a sweetheart. She's in her, what, she's 50 now, I think, you know.
I think you're right.
Yeah, and she's got kids of her own. And, you know, I don't stay in touch with her. My sister has stayed in touch with Lisa over the years. They're very close. But as far as everybody else, those that are left of us, I've been friends with Red and Sonny and Charlie Hodge and J.D. Sumner, all the band members, but most of them are dead.
Yeah.
And every now and then, from time to time, I do European tours with the TCB band. Ronnie Tutt, the drummer, Glendy Harden, the keyboard player, David Briggs, James Burton. They're all my friends.
Wow, James Burton.
Oh, yeah.
One of the best guitarists in the world.
Yeah, they're all my friends. And I call them and talk to them and email them, and I do gigs with them, you know, and stuff from time to time. We have a shrinking number of people. Dick Grobe was the other bodyguard, and he's 80 now, lives in Las Vegas, you know. We just lost Joe Esposito, the road manager. And so somebody earlier today said, well, you're sort of the last of the Mohicans, aren't you? And I'm not sure if that's a compliment or not, you know. But there's a few of us left. But, yeah, I do stay in touch with them.
I'd like to speak to you about your sister, Linda Thompson, and your career regarding her as a songwriter, of course, former girlfriend to Elvis, partner for 4.5 years, but also your career as a musician.
Well, of course, I'm not a musician, although I really wish I was, Gene. You know,
I thought you were.
Oh, well, you know what? Sometimes at these gigs, I walk out on stage after they introduce me, and I say, thank you, I'd like to do a medley of my hits. I'd like to, but I'm incapable of it, you know. But after Elvis died, I actually was in law school, and he had given me a guitar. Actually, it was the last guitar he ever played at Market Square Arena, June of 77. And it was a D28 Martin. And after he died, he'd given me several guitars. And so I didn't think much of it, except I was grateful to have it. But after he died, I realized I had something significant. So I had for the Martin Guitar Company authenticated and Vernon Presley authenticated by affidavit and all that. And I was in law school and I was about to run out of money. And I was at night, going at night because I was a sheriff's deputy in the daytime. And so the National Enquirer tracked me down and the sheriff called me in one day, which is never a good thing, and usually. And the National Enquirer had contacted me through the sheriff's office and wanted to buy my guitar. They were running a national contest, and so I sold it. It was a $600 guitar I sold for $8,000. And I thought that was a fortune in 1979. And so anyway, they took the money and paid off my law school debts, and I finished law school. So I tell everybody else put me through law school indirectly. So I finished, and I was the first sheriff's legal counsel, legal advisor. I used to write the deadly force and pursuit policies and train officers in self-defense, officer survival, karate skills, wrestling, all that. And then I was doing the legal side. And then I got appointed as a warden of a prison, and I was a prison master warden for 2 years, biggest prison in Tennessee, 2,000 inmates, 900 officers.
Jailhouse Rock.
Yeah, and I took it from a federal lawsuit into a release of that. And as a result of that, the governor of Tennessee appointed me as a judge. So I was a juvenile court judge for 2 years in Memphis, and then I ran for an elected office in 1990, an 8-year term, and so I was a trial bench judge, civil court, because by that time, Gene, I'd had enough of criminal law and criminals. So I went to civil court, and all I did was contracts, and I had the complex commercial litigation docket, which heavy contracts and all that. So I really immersed myself in that, and during that period of time, my sister Linda married David Foster, very famous Canadian. He taught me how to
superstar.
He taught me how to say garage or garage. Anyway, so we would go to Victoria, to BC, had a boat up there, and we'd go to the islands, St. Itch and Friday Harbor, and did all that for years. And he had lawyers, but he had a brother-in-law who was a judge. You know how that works. Mm-hmm. So he'd call me for advice. So I started getting my continuing legal education in the entertainment business. And I'm a pretty quick study, and I worked hard, and I learned a lot. And so I was with him when he had the group called The Coors. And we had, in 1995, he had an imprint label with Atlantic that I helped him with. And then in 97, we took a full joint venture with Atlantic and Elektra and Warner's into the Warner Music Group. And I had equity points because of all that. So when I retired from being a judge in 98, I went to California and was Senior Vice President of Business and Legal Affairs for Warner Music Group.
Wow.
And I signed Michael Bublé, I signed Josh Groban. And we had a pretty good run for 5 years. And then we sold our record company back to Warner Brothers, our joint venture partner. And I retired and went to Las Vegas. And I was playing golf, and the guy came up and he said, you don't know me, don't remember me, but I was a congressman, and one of your friends brought me to Memphis. I was a congressman from Nevada, and one of your friends brought me to Memphis, and I wanted to see Graceland, so you took us through Graceland when you were a judge there. I said, well, that's great, man. Thanks for remembering. What are you doing now? He said, well, I'm the governor of Nevada.
Wow.
And I went, really? He said, yeah, let's have lunch. I said, okay.
Yeah.
So the next thing I know, I'm a commissioner of transportation in Nevada. And about a year later, I was moved over. I became chairman of the Public Utilities Commission. So for 6 years, I regulated all the power in the state of Nevada, Las Vegas, and everywhere else. And Warren Buffett owned our utility, and Harry Reid was our senator. So you know I was right in the middle.
Yeah.
So I did that, and I finally retired officially about 6 years ago. And didn't do anything, and now I'm living in Dallas, Texas. But my sister, I'm actually...
Linda Thompson.
Yeah, and she's a very prolific songwriter. She's got over 200 tracks in her catalog, and I represent her publishing. And I'm just now closing her fifth deal with Warner Chappell. She's been with them 20 years, and she wrote, as an example, Grown Up Christmas Wish by Amy Grant and so many others. She wrote.
I believe she wrote the Bodyguard song,
yeah.
I Who Have Nothing. No,
yeah.
I Have Nothing.
I Have Nothing. Whitney's funny story there is that when I first met Elvis, Sissy Houston was in the backup group, the Sweet Inspirations.
Right.
Well, Sissy was Whitney's mother, and Whitney was a little girl. So I remember her in those days. You know,
yeah.
And so you go full circle all these years later, Whitney's a grown woman, and she sings the song that Linda and David wrote, which got nominated for an Academy Award. So she's had a very good musical career. She's the gifted musician in our family. I'm the dancing chicken. What can I tell you?
Not quite the dancing chicken, but here at the corner of Simcoe and Hill, Ontario, at the four corners of Collingwood, in the middle of Elvis Fest, I've had a thrilling conversation with Sam Thompson, one of the Elvis's closest friends, bodyguard to the end, and a great storyteller. Thank you so much, Sam.
You're welcome. And tell the fans to come by and see me. We've got a VIP tent. I'm here with a couple of co-stars, and they've got photos to sell, and I've got stories to tell. So come by and say hello.
Will do. Thanks again, Sam.
Yeah.